Hello and welcome to Banfield. In the world of the Russian super rich, not even true love is safe. Just ask Igor Sechin, the CEO of the Russian state oil company and deputy prime minister before that. In the West, he is known as the Grey Cardinal, Cardinal of the Kremlin. Sometimes he's just referred to as Darth Vader, though. And like most Russian billionaires, he owns at least one mega yacht. This one is called the Amore Vero, Italian for true love. And overnight, the true love tried to slip away weeks ahead of schedule from a shipyard in the south of France where it was undergoing repairs. But the French authorities stepped in and they seized it. C'est la guerre, Darth Vader. All's fair in love and war. Hours later, and an ocean away, the Biden administration added to the sanctions wall of shame, on which Igor Sechin, Darth Vader, has had a place for a couple of days now. Among the newly sanctioned oligarchs and or cronies of the Russian president is Putin's own chief spokesman, whom the White House calls a top purveyor of Putin's propaganda. Also new on the list, a mining tycoon whose own mega yacht was just seized by Germany yesterday. Say goodbye. Auf Wiedersehen. You know that old saying, a mega yacht here, a mega yacht there, and pretty soon we're talking real money? Well, a billionaire named Oleg Deripaska, who made his shady fortunes in aluminum, says that he has had enough. We reported yesterday on his public declaration that, quote, peace is very important. Negotiations need to start as soon as possible, with an exclamation point. But today, he warned his fellow tycoons that Russia faces a, quote, severe economic crisis for a minimum of 3 years. Presumably, Putin is listening, though there is no indication yet that he means to let up or pull back in Ukraine. And I say that because as I report this to you, a Ukrainian nuclear power plant, the biggest one in Europe, is on fire after an onslaught by, you guessed it, Russian troops. Ukraine's foreign minister is warning that the fallout could be worse than Chernobyl, 10 times worse. Putin says the war is being, quote, successfully accomplished. That's not to say that he hasn't taken some losses himself. This week, World Taekwondo delivered a blow to Putin, no doubt that he considers below the belt. But he's wrong, because it is his belt that they took. A ninth degree black belt, that's the highest rank that you can reach in Taekwondo. And let's be crystal clear here, that's a nice picture. But it's an honorary belt. It was honorary when they gave it to him in 2013, and now it's dishonorary because they've taken it away. The organization says this, quote, the brutal attacks on innocent lives in Ukraine go against the World Taekwondo vision of peace is more precious than triumph. And with that, I want to welcome my guests. Michael Weiss is a news director of New Lines magazine, and he's the author of an upcoming history on Russian military intelligence. Julia Manchester is a national political reporter for The Hill. And Peter Klein is founder and executive director of the Global Reporting Center. He's working on a documentary about global corruption. So perfect three guests to have. I'm going to get into all that stuff that I just talked about in a moment. But first, I just want to see if I can get right to this breaking news. This started to really blow up, pardon the pun there, before we came on air. Europe's largest nuclear plant is under assault. The foreign minister says if this doesn't end, if the shelling and the attack from the Russians doesn't end, that this could be 10 times worse than Chernobyl. That got a lot of people, for lack of a better word, freaking out. Let me ask you right off the bat, Peter Klein, what do you know about it? And how much concern should there really be around the world right now of this assault?
I mean, I know what we've heard in the news, but, you know, if you think about Chernobyl, I was just in Finland 2 days ago, and a group of Finnish people were talking to me about this exact concern that if a nuclear plant were to be hit, the fallout would be so widespread. They felt the impact of Chernobyl, you know, two countries away. So I think that this is going to have, you know, a significant impact, I think, even as it is right now. But certainly if it continues burning, if the predictions are 10 times worse than Chernobyl, I mean, you know, that's going to be felt all over Europe.
Yeah. So to that end, Julia, I have heard some analysts say, and it certainly did chasing me somewhat, that there are internal structures that are built within this, and pardon my pronunciation, Zaporizhia, I think it's called, the nuclear plant, but that there are internal structures built within the Zaporizhia, perhaps counseled from what happened in Chernobyl, that are sort of like sarcophaguses within the sarcophaguses to limit the damage. Think about the Titanic with different sections that if they flood, they're shut off. Do you know anything about that, or can you expound on that at all?
You know, I don't know anything about that at the moment. However, I do understand from some reports that have come out, Ashley, that, you know, say that one of the reactors that is under construction has been hit. However, it's not operating at the moment. But I think the struggle that, you know, this plant has right now is that they can't even get firefighters into the scene to help put out this plant because Russia continues to shell it. So it's just an awful situation unfolding around this plant and, you know, where, you know, assuming that people live relatively close by or, you know, in this general vicinity for the people that work there, that, you know, they can't even put out the fire here, that Russia is continuing to shell. And obviously there could be dire humanitarian consequences if something is hit and we have a, you know, a nuclear disaster, a nuclear issue really unfold. And, you know, I think we've heard warning signs about this over the past week or so, and here we are.
Yeah, Michael Weiss, I want to get you in on this as well. And I just want to alert our viewers to what they're seeing on the screen. There's a live feed that's coming in from the Zaporizhia. And I'm sure that if I'm not pronouncing it right, you'll school me on that, I hope. And just as Julia mentioned, the firefighters are struggling to get there, which makes this all the more distressing. But the director general of the IAEA said just recently to CNN that what makes this unprecedented is that it's the first time in post-Second World War history that we have a full-fledged military operation amidst a big number of nuclear facilities, including nuclear reactors. And all of this is chilling, but that, you know, gets you, you know, right to the gut. At the same time, we are hearing reports there are no increased or elevated levels of radiation. But expound on what you're seeing and what you're hearing, Michael.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is really a kind of chilling scenario, isn't it? I think this is the largest nuclear reactor in Europe. And, you know, we've just come off of a 72-hour news cycle talking about, well, what are the consequences of if the United States and NATO imposed a no-fly zone in Ukraine? Well, it would lead to direct military engagement with Russia, and therefore that would lead to World War III, and therefore that would lead to the possible dire contingency of some kind of nuclear engagement. And here you see the Russians firing artillery shells at a nuclear power plant, and you know, with the potential consequences of, I defer to the nuclear scientists on this, but from what I saw a few hours ago, before the IAEA said the moment of crisis has passed, there was a potentiality here for something quite catastrophic to take place. Whether or not it would have been on orders of magnitudes higher than what we saw in Chernobyl, but I will say this, Ashley. Whatever happened and whatever crisis we've just averted or are still in the midst of, I can guarantee you that the line that would come out of Moscow if there was a disaster, if people did get irradiated or there was some kind of nuclear fallout, would be absolutely no different than the line from 1986, which now, fortunately, a lot of people, including Americans, are well versed in from having watched that whatever part series on HBO Chernobyl. Lies, disinformation, cover-up. I mean, this has been the kind of modus operandi from the very beginning of this war, which was completely unwarranted and launched without provocation by Vladimir Putin, including with pre-recorded. I mean, we now have evidence that the war plan was concocted in January, right? So all of these lines about false flag attacks, the Ukrainians had attacked so-called separatists in Donbass, all of this has proven to be false. So why the Russians would do this? Why they would roll the wheel of fortune to possibly kill loads of people, innocent civilians? I answer my own question. This is madness.
Yeah, and we are getting, you know, word that the direct shelling may have stopped. I say may because, look, there's a reason it's called fog of war. Information is tricky at best and messy at the least. The pictures you're seeing were recorded from earlier where you can actually see the assault taking place. There was a fire burning. And at this point, you know, we have heard about ceasefires before for negotiations and then shazam. Entire villages and towns are under assault. So not sure that Vladimir Putin is worth his word. But that is a grave concern without question to see that. And let's just be clear. The winds are blowing east, right? So they're going to blow into Russia. So if this is a scorched earth attempt, he's going to kill a bunch of Russians this way in Russia. It just seems like complete madness. But that's sort of where we feel like we're at. Let me switch gears. I'm going to keep an eye on that during this program. But Peter, I just want to switch gears to this. Last night we showed the dictionary definition of oligarch. But you, my friend, wrote a better one in a piece that you co-wrote for the Toronto Globe and Mail. You described oligarch as the coterie of thieving billionaires that Putin allows to dip into states' resources. The question I have with such a great definition is, what binds Putin to the oligarchs now and vice versa?
I mean, I think you have to put it in the historical context. When the Soviet Union collapsed, Eastern Europe emerged with a sort of an economic system. There's certainly lots of corruption right now in Eastern Europe, but it emerged with a somewhat healthy capitalist system that was established. The Soviet Union was unable to do that for a variety of reasons, partly because the former, you know, people in power, the KGB folks like that, essentially took over a lot of the economic power. You know, even under Yeltsin, there was this, you know, real grab for power. And certainly by the time Putin came on board, there were so many people who were wealthy who were controlling the politics and the economics of that country. And so he surrounded himself by these people who are making themselves wealthy. There's a lot of talk of, you know, Putin is the richest person in the world. From what I can tell, Putin doesn't care all that much about wealth. Maybe he has a yacht, maybe he has a mansion, but you know, he can't really enjoy that stuff because he's, you know, he makes $140,000 a year as a leader of this country, and he's probably pretty busy doing that, waging war right now. But the people around him are able to, you know, as you showed, you know, they have yachts, they have, you know, all sorts of assets that are now being seized. And those are the people who have kept him in power. Those are the people who are protecting him. And so, I mean, I think the efforts now are to try to wear away at those folks who will then ultimately pressure Putin to relent. You know, the president gave a State of the Union speech and essentially started by saying, hey, we're going to go after your jets, we're going to go after your mansions and your yachts. The next day, Putin bombed a nuclear plant. So I don't know if it's working, but that seems to be the strategy that you know, people are taking, that let's go after the assets.
Everybody thinks that, you know, on paper, it's so simple, you know, just take out these guys. A, they're great friends. B, they completely depend on Putin to allow them to continue their kleptocracy. And C, if they put enough pressure on him, they've got his ear. If they don't like what's happening, then, you know, that will have an effect. To that end, that's kind of what the president said today during a cabinet meeting. I just want to play a quick moment. It was literally the first thing he said when the reporters came in for the pool spray. Take a look at this.
The severe economic sanctions on Putin and all those folks around him, choking off access to technology as well as cutting off access to the global financial system. It's had a profound impact already. And the goal was to maximize the impact on Putin and Russia and to minimize the harm on us and our allies and friends around the world.
Aha, that last line. Minimize the effect on our allies and us. Okay. So, Julia, my question is this. The real sanctions, the sanctions that would really cripple Vladimir Putin, that would really cripple Russia, that might actually have an effect, are not the kinds of sanctions that any of us are prepared to live with, because they will also have a profound effect on little old me, on the Eastern Seaboard, and someone in Nebraska, and someone in Washington State, and in Europe, and in Canada, and the list goes on and on. Where am I wrong?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, when you look at the grip Russia has on oil and natural gas production, I mean, it is very difficult to sanction that or to somehow cut much of the Western world off of that. I mean, it was very surprising, I think, and shocking to a lot of Westerners to watch Germany announce that the Nord Stream 2 pipeline production on that would be halted. However, at the same time, there is still connections between the U.S. and Russia, Western Europe and Russia, and that's in the form of energy. And that would obviously be difficult for Western Europe and the United States and the UK right now, because we're all suffering through inflation and rising gas prices. And I'm not saying that Biden is making all of these decisions with an eye towards politics in a midterm election year, but he is getting a lot of the brunt for inflation right now. That is Republicans' messaging against Democrats, and polling shows that it's working. So there clearly has to be a calculus as to, you know, maybe how to approach this and not to completely have this backlash on the United States economy. Instead, they want to go after these oligarchs, many of whom have ties to the U.S., obviously, and Western Europe. But in terms of the oil, natural gas, and energy, that's very difficult for the president right now.
Yeah, there's that guy you were just looking at, not that one, but the bigger, heavier set guy who was walking with Putin. That's Alexei Mordashov. He's the richest man in Russia. $21.9 billionaire is estimated wealth. That's him. Young guy, too. I think he's just in his 50s, and he's been a billionaire since he was in his 30s. Michael, I have this question about these guys. I have been so fascinated by this that I've just been reading everything I can get my hands on. And it's not exactly as I thought it was. I thought the squeeze play was so simple and delicious and full of schadenfreude and you know, the rise and the fall and the really hard fall from the ninth floor of your yacht. It doesn't look that way to me anymore. It looks to me that over the decades, their influence on Putin has ebbed and flowed, and it's been flowing a lot more than ebbing lately. And it's because, potentially, Putin is more interested in surrounding himself with his former KGB types, and has an increasing paranoia of the others. And so he has cut them loose and said, here you go, take your money and shut up. Just shut up wherever you are, take your money, but I don't need you around me. And then weirdly, we see them visit him at the Kremlin last week. What is your assessment of who actually is his inner coterie now?
Well, I think it's a little more complicated than that. You know, you mentioned Igor Sechin, who is the CEO of Rosneft, which is, or was until maybe 72 hours ago, I haven't checked the market rates, the world's largest oil company. Igor Sechin is a former officer of the GRU, the Soviet and now Russian military intelligence service. So he's one of the so-called siloviki, the security hawks or the strong men of Russia that Putin has typically surrounded himself with and came up with in the security services. Putin himself, of course, is a former KGB lieutenant colonel, a case officer. A lot of the guys that we have been talking about who became oligarchs actually have backgrounds in the Soviet and Russian intelligence services. When you talk about oligarchs, though, I mean, I think yesterday I used the phrase plenipotentiaries of the regime, of the Kremlin. Basically, I think there's a good rule of thumb here. If you are a billionaire and you are allowed to stay a billionaire and to go abroad to the West, buy sports clubs, newspapers, mega yachts, invest in real estate in Knightsbridge, in chateaus and chalets in Europe, et cetera, there's an expectation. Two expectations, I would say. Number one, there's a kickback to the boss. Number two, you have to act as sort of a servant of the Kremlin. You have to advance Russia's strategic and national interests. I mean, we've talked a lot about this guy, Roman Abramovich, who has yet to be sanctioned, and I'm very curious as to why. But if you look at the investigations, Ashley, that Alexei Navalny, the now imprisoned Russian opposition leader, has done, very detailed, granular, document-based investigations, you will always find that whenever we're dealing with any of these guys, typically, they are very much, there's persuasive evidence to suggest that they act as so-called wallets of, if not Putin himself, then other high-ranking members of the Russian government. Abramovich is no exception. Vladimir Putin has spent the last 10 years building himself, it doesn't even do justice to call it a dacha. It's not a palace. It's a property, an expanse of territory that I believe is 29 times the size of the Principality of Monaco, right? And all of the cronies that he came up with,
going back to his days, that surrounds it is amazing. That's the one with the underground hockey rink, right? We're showing the pictures now.
Underground hockey rink, vineyards, helipads, servants' quarters, aqua disco, which you have to look that up in the dictionary because I still don't know what the hell that means.
Theater.
There's a hookah lounge. a theater, a hookah lounge with a stripper pole in there. All of this, according to Navalny, and I encourage everybody watching this program, you can Google it. It's a two-hour video presentation. It's one of the most compelling and disturbing things I've ever seen.
Yeah, if you can see it on your screen right now, it's amazing, Michael. So let me just read two things that, while you say that these wallets, these billionaire oligarchs have to toe the line, be good ambassadors for Putin's message and mission in Russia, we have two oligarchs with statements today that stood out slightly, and I say slightly because read between these lines. First is Alexei Mordachev, who is the richest Russian. I mentioned him before. He said this, and he said it to TASS, for what that's worth, Russian wire service. What's happening in Ukraine is a tragedy for two fraternal nations. It is terrible that Ukrainians and Russians are dying. I don't know how many Russians are, but people are suffering hardships and the economy is collapsing. I sincerely hope a way can be found in the very near future to resolve this conflict and stop the bloodshed. Doesn't really indict the Russians, that's for sure, but it is, they are words. We'll give them that, they're words. And so a fellow oligarch named Mikhail Friedman, and we talked about him, Michael, yesterday, said this mm-hmm. crisis will cost lives and damage two nations who have been brothers for hundreds of years. While a solution seems frighteningly far off, I can only join those whose fervent desire is for the bloodshed to end. So I'm going to give this last word to Julia. And Julia, like I said, their words, which I guess is more than nothing, but they sound pretty compliant. Does that just about wrap that up?
Absolutely. They're walking a very fine line. They obviously do not want to cross Vladimir Putin, and they obviously want to keep face with their Western connections. So they're, condemning what's happening, or condemning, I should say, the situation in Ukraine, but not directly drawing Russia into it. But, it's interesting. We have seen oligarchs in the past who have, at least one who've spoken out against Putin. They've been jailed, and then eventually they're exiled, living in Western countries like Britain, for example. It's not just the oligarchs, I think, that have, if they speak out incorrectly, they against Putin, they risk his backlash. We showed that video from Alexei Navalny, for example. All of these, these journalists and investigators in Russia that have the courage to try to uncover Putin's wealth and his extravagant lifestyle and really tear away from this facade that he's a man of the Russian people, they face so much, they really risk their lives. We obviously know that Alexei Navalny has been imprisoned. He's been poisoned in the past. Boris Nemtsov, who also worked to uncover this lifestyle of Putin and his, corruption, he was assassinated in Moscow. So, it's awful to really see this all unfold and see how.
Let me toss another name in there just to button it all up. Mikhail Khodorkovsky, formerly the wealthiest man in Russia, spent a decade in prison because he dared to speak out. Michael Weiss, Julia Manchester, Peter Klein, thank you all three. Just extremely smart people at a time when we really need smart people. Thank you. Appreciate it. Coming up, he is not from Ukraine. He's not even Ukrainian. So why is this man quitting his job, packing up, and heading off to fight the Russians? Well, we can ask him live because he's with me next. Okay, I want to continue our breaking news coverage. I opened the program telling you that there had been an attack on the largest nuclear power plant in Europe. This is in Ukraine. Look at those pictures. Those are that's the evidence of Russia actually shelling a nuclear power plant called the Zaporizhia. The mayor of that town, extraordinarily concerned, the foreign minister saying if the shelling didn't stop, this would be 10 times Chernobyl. There is word that much of it has stopped, but the U.S. has already responded. The U.S. Secretary of Energy, Jennifer Granholm, tweeting out just moments ago that she's been speaking with Ukraine's energy minister about this, that the U.S. has now activated the Nuclear Incident Response Team. They're monitoring the situation along with the Department of Defense, excuse me, and the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Not to mention that the White House is also watching what's going on. Perhaps good news, though, in all of this, that the radiation levels are still normal. But the quote here from Jennifer Granholm, the Secretary of Energy, pardon me, Russian military operations near the plant are reckless and must cease. Pardon me as I'm choking while I'm saying that, but we're keeping a very close eye on that breaking news for you. It generates about 20% of Ukraine's nuclear energy, and so it's a critical spot without question. So as we watch this, presumably things are still burning because the fire response teams weren't able to get there. But at this point, luckily, radiation levels are still normal. So I'm going to continue on with the program while we continue to watch that breaking story as well, because honestly, I don't know how else to put this, but it does feel pretty helpless, right, to just sit here and watch this all. We're 5,000 miles away. And all the people surrounding what you're looking at there, they're all just innocent Ukrainians, right? And if they're not going to be, you know, infected by whatever's going on at that plant, they're being slaughtered by whatever is, you know, coming down from above, the shells and the missiles. And again, they're normal people just like you. Vladimir Putin just continues to pummel them with missiles, rockets, bombs. And then, you know, that's even before the tanks roll in and then completely overwhelm cities. This is what they look at out their window. Imagine doing that. These were normal towns and cities before fire and brimstone rolled in. So no surprise that a million people have run for their lives, right? But here's the interesting story. Millions more are staying. They're staying so that they can help the Ukrainian soldiers fight back, even if they're not soldiers, because this is a David and Goliath battle. The really sad part of all of it is that there is no other cavalry coming to help the outgunned Ukrainian forces. Ukraine is not part of NATO, so they have pretty much been left high and dry to fight this battle on their own. But that has not stopped the Ukrainian president from making a worldwide appeal, asking thousands of people from all over the globe to pack up, come to the Ukraine, and join us in what he calls the International Legion of Volunteers. Basically foreign fighters who will come and fight for him. Now, that request caught the attention of the United States Secretary of State here, stateside. Take a look what Antony Blinken said.
Look, we've been very clear for some time, of course, in calling on Americans who may have been resident in Ukraine to leave, and making clear to Americans who may be thinking of traveling there not to go.
Well, nevertheless, people are going. They're not just going from the U.S., they're going from Canada, France, and the U.K., and Thailand, and Japan, just to name a few places. And in some cases, they have military experience, and in other cases, they have nothing. No experience, maybe never even handled a gun. But there is a checklist at the Ukrainian embassies that they are going to ask for, including bringing your own tactical gear. And by the way, if you do have a soldier's uniform from your country, they'd be real pleased if you would wear it. You have got to admit that this is a huge ask, right? When life is so safe and warm wherever you're sitting right now. But after the break, you're going to meet Bryson Woolsey. He's a young man who just chucked his job and all of his creature comforts to travel those 5,000 miles east and shoot at some Russians. And Bryson's going to join you next. You have to admit, it is astounding to see civilians who just last week were working 9 to 5 and looking after their kids. But they're now committing themselves to facing down the invading Russian forces and fighting hand to hand if need be. Check out what this Ukrainian man had to say to News Nation's Robert Sherman.
I was afraid in the beginning, nervous at the beginning, but then I saw how our army is professional, because myself, I'm ready to fight. I don't know how to fight, but if they would teach me, I would know that my life then had its goal.
Those inspirational stories are not lost on thousands of people around the world who just cannot sit idly by and watch as this war plays out. Thousands of foreigners have now answered the call of the Ukrainian president to pack up their things and pick up a gun and come and fight alongside Ukraine. Bryson Woolsey is one of them. He just quit his job as a cook in British Columbia, Canada, and plans to head east to fight the Russians. Like millions of others, he watched the images on TV of the Russian army just crushing Ukrainian civilians, and he made a decision to help. Bryson Woolsey joins me now live along with Howard Altman, who is the managing editor of the Military Times and is an award-winning former editor and military reporter for the Tampa Bay Times and the Tampa Tribune. Welcome to both of you. So, Bryson, I'm going to begin with you. As I understand it, you don't have combat experience. You don't speak Russian or Ukrainian, but you've made this decision. How did you get there?
Yeah, I mean, just like you were saying, is watching it, I didn't really have a way to help. I felt kind of helpless, and I wanted to help. But then he reached out for people that they moved to requirement for combat experience. So I thought, okay, well, I can get over there, do something then. And I just jumped on it. And just been kind of going from there. It's kind of snowballed into what it is today. But yeah, there's actually a couple of reporters double checked this too, but we're not allowed to cross now without combat experience. So it's actually, I'm going to be going to Romania to work on the border there, bring my gear there, and if something changes while I'm there, I'll come over. But yeah, just out of the blue, they just decided that no combat experience, no go. So that just, so I don't know if it's been where people are.
That's aware. It's pretty amazing that, you know, you're doing this. It's a long way away. It's a risky proposition no matter where, you know, you are. Howard, I want you to jump in on this because I was reading your article and you put together a pretty comprehensive checklist, which I found to be just fascinating. I mean, it got real. It got very real once I looked at your checklist. And I'm going to put that up for the public to see right now. And this is what you got to do if you're thinking of doing what Bryson's doing. You got to go to the Ukrainian embassy in your country. You got to have your documents in order, like your ID, your passport, and any of your military service documents or policing documents. You got to fill out an application. You got to sit for an interview. And then you kind of just, you know, wait for your travel instructions. So it's fascinating, Howard. What do you make of the immense interest all around the world to heed Zelensky's call for help?
Well, I've talked to a number of veterans who've expressed interest, very similar to what took place after the fall of Afghanistan. People feel helpless as they watch the events unfold. They want to go out and help do something. The Ukrainian government is very strict in what they are asking for. They do not want anybody without combat experience to come and fight. You have to have combat experience, otherwise stay home. So far, about 3,000 Americans have applied for the International Legion of Territorial Defense of Ukraine. I was told by a Ukrainian official in Kyiv that several hundred foreign fighters have already arrived. You cannot bring a gun. They will provide you with a gun and maybe some other weapons. They don't want anybody who's untrained, as they told me this morning. We're too busy, to train anyone. So really
sure.
Think
well,
hard
that makes
about
sense.
This before
I mean, right?
You go.
These guys are busy fighting, and so they can't train the untrained. They're already trying to train people who live in these, you know, communities in Ukraine. Bryson, I read something from an American guy named Dax. He didn't want his last name used. He's 26 years old. He's a veteran of the extraordinarily elite U.S. 82nd Airborne Division here in the U.S. And he said, and I'll quote him, "I feel guilty not to go." And I can identify with that because seeing all these pictures, it's just heartbreaking. I am heartbroken all day and all night as I have the news on. And I wonder if you felt the same way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm laying in bed watching it on a laptop while these guys are fighting their heart out and suffering. And it's just like kind of puts things in perspective a little bit, you know, like, here I am, I have the ability to go do something, help in a way, some way, and it felt wrong, absolutely uncomfortable to just let it happen. And I'm not the only one, like there's lots of people that have reached out to me since, and they feel the same way. They felt called to go help, whether they were medical or military or just another volunteer like me. But yeah, it's really rallied people to the cause here.
Well, listen, be careful, Bryson. This is the big show. I mean, this is scary stuff. And so if you're going to be in Romania, that's a better place than being in country in Ukraine, especially without the skills that some of these really intense fighters have. But keep us posted and let us know how you're doing. Bryson, thank you for doing this. And Howard Altman, it's good to see you. Thanks for this.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
You know, it is easy to feel completely helpless as you watch a million people running for their lives, right? 5,000 miles away. But even if grabbing a gun and fighting isn't on your list, there is something that you can do right now in America that will make a huge difference, and you do not even have to get out of the chair you're in right now. After the break, the instant blueprint on how to save children. Tomorrow in Morning America, a tale of two leaders, a closer look at the differences between Putin and Zelensky. I'm going to continue to update that story on the nuclear power plant in southeastern Ukraine. We have reaction from the White House live tonight. As you see on the right of your screen, under assault, a nuclear power plant, the largest one in Europe, in fact, under assault by the Putin government in Ukraine. The U.S. Energy Secretary, Jennifer Granholm, has tweeted out that both the Department of Defense and the Energy Department watching the situation in eastern Ukraine closely with the respect to this nuclear power plant. They've also, and this is the more worrisome aspect of it, activated the nuclear incident response team. They have said, and this might be the best news of all of this awful news, that the radiation readings have not elevated. It's also good to know that way off in the distance there where that fire is, even though the fire teams couldn't reach it to fight the fire, and that the shelling had continued from multiple sides of that nuclear power plant. It is well constructed with concrete barriers to try to contain any kind of disaster. Probably lessons learned from Chernobyl, but the foreign minister said if the shelling didn't stop, it would be 10 times Chernobyl. So the White House watching closely, the energy secretary on it, and you're going to hear a lot more about what the nuclear incident response team is doing now that it's been activated. So there is this as well. It's really as if the city of San Jose just emptied out and showed up at your doorstep, because that's what it looks like when a million people grab what they can and run for their lives to escape shelling and missile attacks from an invader. 1 million people, the entire population of San Jose, on the run and now in need of food and clothing and blankets and somewhere to sleep. And if they've got little kids with them, you know how much more they need than just those basics. To make this story even more bewildering, this wholesale flood of humanity began just a week ago, just 1 week ago tonight, a million people. And you better brace yourself, because the number's expected to increase fivefold to 5 million. 5 million innocent women and children. International organizations are flooding in from all over the world to help make a difference for the suffering. Save the Children is one of them, a big one. And they've been in Ukraine since 2014, helping children and families. But now the playbook has changed, and they're feverishly setting up centers in neighboring Poland and Lithuania and Romania to help the refugees as they arrive by the hundreds of thousands. Joining me right now, Greg Ram. He's the head of the humanitarian response for Save the Children. Greg, where do you even begin? Tell me what you need and how everybody watching can help.
Well, thank you for sharing the story and the need. I mean, as our Save the Children's founder said 100 years ago, every war is first a war against children. And that's as true today as it was 100 years ago. So what we need and what children need is they need food, they need water, they need safety. They need blankets in the middle of winter. They need a safe place to be, a place to be with other children. They need an ability to recover from the extraordinary trauma of being caught in the middle of war.
So important. When people want to give, sometimes they go to their garage and they get their things that they don't want anymore and they start sending physical things. And that is, there's nothing more difficult for an organization like yours, because that means I need staff, I need warehouses, things will rot if we can't get to them fast enough. I suppose you'll agree with me if I say just money. Money, it goes much farther than anything else, correct?
Absolutely. It is the thing that is most useful, and it is actually the thing that is often most useful to families. So, first of all, as you say, the logistical challenges of taking those donated goods, all given with good intention, is almost impossible to get and get across and distribute. But also, when we're giving cash donations where we can, where there are local markets and stores and people can work, we try to give cash to families, because they know best what they need when they arrive in a strange place and set up. But we also use those for blankets, for food, for hygiene items, for diapers, for everything you might imagine, children need as they flee war, with often with nothing more than the clothes on their backs.
It's unbelievable to read that over 400 children right now are in the direct line of fire. Here's what I'm going to do, Greg Graham. Thank you for what you said. I'm going to put up the address to donate to Save the Children. People, right now, wherever you are, use your phone, use your laptop, use your tablet. Go to savethechildren.org/Ukraine. Savethechildren.org/Ukraine. The Crisis Relief Fund is trying to reach the millions and millions of children and their families who need immediate aid with recovery. And so you can do that, and it's real easy, and you don't have to do much more. Just savethechildren.org. After the break, the president has asked Congress to approve $32.5 billion to help the people of Ukraine, but there is a brand new way that Americans are giving on their own, one we haven't seen much in the past. How much? And what are your fellow countrymen giving? How are they sending it overseas? Here's a hint. Doesn't involve cash, checks, or even banks. Solving the mystery next. So before the break, I told you about a brand new movement afoot in the USA to send money to the Ukraine, and it is not banks or checks, it is cryptocurrency. And Americans have sent $50 million in cryptocurrency to the Ukraine. It's pretty fascinating stuff.